Chapter 32. There was neither clock nor calendar in my cell. I do not know how many standard days, weeks, or months I was beyond the reach of sanity. I may have gone many days without sleeping, or slept for weeks on end. It is difficult or impossible to tell. But eventually, when the cyanide and the laws of quantum chance continued to spare me from day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute, I began this narrative. I do not know why my imprisoners provided me with a slate text scriber and stylus and the ability to print a few pages of recycled microvellum. Perhaps they saw the possibility of the condemned man writing his confession or using the scriber stylus as an impotent way to rage at his judges and jailers. Or perhaps they saw the condemned man's writing of his sins and injuries, joys and losses of joy, as an additional source of punishment. And perhaps, in a way, it was. But it was also my salvation. At first, it saved me from the insanity and self-destruction of uncontrollable grief and remorse. Then it saved my memories of Anea, pulling them from the quagmire of horror at her terrible death, to the firmer ground of our days together, her joy of living, her mission, our travels, and her complex but terribly straightforward message to me and all humankind. Eventually, it simply saved my life. Soon after beginning the narrative, I discovered that I could share the thoughts and actions of any of the participants in our long odyssey and failed struggle. I knew that this was a function of what Anea had taught me through discussion and communion, with learning the language of the dead and the language of the living. I still encountered the dead in my sleeping and waking dreams. My mother often spoke to me, and I tasted the agony and wisdom of uncounted others who had lived and died long ago. But it was not these lost souls who obsessed me now. It was those with some parallel view of my own experiences in all my years of knowing Anea. Never during my time waiting for death in the Schrödinger cat box did I believe that I could hear the current thoughts of the living beyond my prison. I assumed that the fused energy shell of the orbital egg somehow prevented that. But I soon learned how to shut out the clamor of all those countless older voices resonating in the void which binds, and concentrate on the memories of those dead as well as presumably still living, who had been part of Anea's story. Thus I entered into at least some of the thoughts and motives of human beings so different from my own way of thinking as to be literally alien creatures. Cardinals Simon Augustino Lourdesami and John Domenico Mustafa, Lennar Hoyt in his incarnations as Pope Julius and Pope Urban XVI, mercantilist traders such as Kenzo Isozaki and Anna Pelli Cognani, priests and warriors such as Father DeSoya, Sergeant Gregorius, Captain Margaret Wu, and Executive Officer Hogan Leibler. Some of the characters in my tale are present in the void which binds, largely as scars, holes, vacancies. The Nemes creatures are such vacuums, as are Counselor Albedo and the other core entities. But I was able to track some of the movements and actions of these beings simply by the movement of that vacancy through the matrix of sentient emotion that was the void, much as one would see the outline of an invisible man in a hard rain. Thus, in combination with listening to the soft murmurings of the human dead, I could reconstruct Radamanth Nemesis' slaughter of the innocents on Sol Draconi Septim, and hear the sibilant hissings and see the deadly actions of Scylla, Gyges, Briareus, and Nemes on Vitus Grey Balianus B. But as distasteful and disorienting as these descents into moral vacuum and mental nightmare were to me, they were balanced by a taste again of the warmth of such friends as Demloa, Demria, Father Glaucus, Hetmastine, Abetic, and all the rest. Many of these participants in the tale I sought out only through my own memory. Wonderful people such as Lomo Dondrup, last seen flying off on his wings of pure light in his gallant and hopeless battle against the Pax warships, and Rachel, living the second of several lives she was destined to fill with adventure, and the regal Dorji Famo and the wise young Dalai Lama. In this way, I was using the void which binds to hear my own voice, to clarify memory beyond the ability and clarity of memory. And in that sense, I often saw myself as a minor character in my own tale, a not too intelligent follower, usually reacting rather than leading, often failing to ask questions when he should, or accepting answers all too inadequate. But I also saw the lumbering Rawl Endymion of the tale as a man discovering love with a person he had waited for all of his life. And in that sense, his willingness to follow without question was often balanced by his willingness to give his life in an instant for his dear friend. Although I know without doubt that Anea is dead, I never sought her voice among the chorus of those speaking the language of the dead. Rather, I felt her presence throughout the void which binds, felt her touch in the minds and hearts of all the good people who wandered through our odyssey, or had their lives changed forever in our long struggle with the packs. As I learned to dim the insensate clamor and pick out specific voices among the chorus of the dead, I realized that I often visualized these human resonances in the void as stars, some dim but visible when one knew where to look, others blazing like supernovas, still others existing in binary combinations with other former living souls, or set forever in a constellation of love and relationship with specific individuals. Others, like Mustafa and Lourdes Sami and Hoyt, all but burned out and imploded by the terrible gravity of their ambition or greed or lust for power, their human radiance all but lost as they collapsed into black holes of the spirit. But Anea was not one of these stars. She was like the sunlight that had surrounded us during a walk on a warming spring day in the meadows above Taliesin West. Constant, diffuse, flowing from a single source, but warming everything and everyone around us, a source of life and energy. And as when winter comes or night falls, the absence of that sunlight brings the cold and darkness, and we wait for spring and morning. But I knew that there would be no mourning for Anea now, no resurrection for her and our love affair. The great power of her message is that the Pack's version of resurrection was a lie, as sterile as the required birth control injections administered by the Pack's. In a finite universe of would-be immortals, there is almost no room for children. The Pack's universe was ordered and static, unchanging and sterile. Children bring chaos and clutter, and an infinite potential for the future that was anathema to the Pack's. As I thought of this, and pondered Anea's last gift to me, the antidote to the Pack's birth control implant within me, I wondered if it had been a primarily metaphorical gesture. I hoped that Anea had not been suggesting that I use it literally, that I find another love, a wife, have children with someone else. In one of our many conversations, she and I had discussed that once. I remember it was while sitting in the vestibule of her shelter near Taliesin as the evening wind blew the scent of yucca and primrose to us. That strange elasticity of the human heart in finding new relationships, new people to share one's life with, new potentials. But I hoped that Anea's gift of fertility in that last few minutes we were together in St. Peter's Basilica was a metaphor for the wider gift she had already given humanity. The option for chaos and clutter and wonderful unseen options. If it was a literal gift, a suggestion that I find a new love, have children with someone else, then Anea had not known me at all. In my writing of this narrative, I had seen all too well through the eyes of too many others that Rawl Endymion was a likable enough fellow, trustworthy, awkwardly valiant on occasion, but not known for his insight or intelligence. But I was smart enough and insightful enough, at least into my own soul, to know for certain that this one love had been enough for my lifetime. And while I grew to realize, as the days and weeks and then almost certainly months passed in my death cell with no arrival of death, that if I somehow miraculously returned to the universe of the living, I would seek out joy and laughter and friendship again, but not a pale shadow of the love I had felt. Not children. No. For a few wonderful days while writing the text, I convinced myself that Aeneia had returned from the dead, that some sort of miracle had been possible. I had just reached the part of my narrative where we had reached Old Earth, passing through the Farcaster on God's Grove after the terrible encounter with the first Nemes thing, and had finished that section with a description of our arrival at Taliesin West. The night after finishing that first chunk of our story, I dreamed that Aeneia had come to me there, in the Schrödinger death cell, had called my name in the dark, touched my cheek, and whispered to me, "We're leaving here, Rall, my darling. Not soon, but as soon as you finish your tale, as soon as you remember it all and understand it all." When I awoke, I had found that the stylus scriber had been activated, and on its pages, in Aeneia's distinctive handwriting, was a long note from her, including some excerpts from her father's poetry. For days, weeks, I was convinced that this had been a real visitation, a miracle of the sort the later apostles had insisted was visited on the original disciples after Jesus' execution. And I worked on the narrative at a fever pitch, desperate to see it all, record it all, and understand it all. But the process took me more months, and in that time I came to realize that the visit from Aeneia must have been something else altogether. My first experience of hearing a whisper of her among the voices of the dead in the void almost certainly, and possibly somehow, an actual message from her stored in the memory of the scriber and set to be triggered when I wrote those pages. It was not beyond possibility. One thing that had been certain was my darling friend's ability to catch glimpses of the future. Futures, she always said, emphasizing the plural. It might have been possible for her to store that beautiful note in a scriber, and somehow see to it that the instrument was included in my Schrödinger cat box cell. Or, and this is the explanation I have come to accept, I wrote that note myself while totally immersed, although possessed might be a better word, in Aeneia's persona as I pursued its essence through the void and my own memories. This theory is the least pleasing to me, but it conforms with Aeneia's only expressed view of the afterlife, based as it was more or less on the Judaic tradition of believing that people live on after death only in the hearts and memories of those they loved, and those they served, and those they saved. At any rate, I wrote for more months, began to see the true immensity and futility of Aeneia's brave quest and hopeless sacrifice, and then I finished the frenzied scribbling, found the courage to describe Aeneia's terrible death and my own helplessness as she died, wept as I printed out the last few pages of microvellum, read them, recycled them, ordered the scriber to keep the complete narrative in its memory, and shut the stylus off for what I thought was the final time. Aeneia did not appear. She did not lead me out of captivity. She was dead. I felt her absence from the universe as clearly as I had felt any resonance from the void which binds since my communion. So I lay in my Schrödinger cat box, tried to sleep, forgot to eat, and waited for death. Some of my explorations among the voices of the dead had led to revelations that had no direct relevance to my narrative. Some were personal and private, waking dreams of my long-dead father hunting with his brothers, for instance, and an insight into the generosity of that quiet man I had never known, or chronicles of human cruelty that, like the memories of Jacob Shulman from the forgotten 20th century, acted only as subtext for my deeper understanding of today's barbarisms. But other voices. So I had finished a narrative of my life with Aeneia and was waiting to die, spending longer and longer sleep periods, hoping that the decisive quantum event would occur while I was asleep, aware of the text in the memory of my scriber, and wondering vaguely if anyone would ever figure out a way through the fix-to-explode-if-tampered-with shell of my Schrödinger box, and find my narrative someday, perhaps centuries hence, when I fell asleep again and had this dream. I knew at once that this was not a regular dream, that wavefront dance of possibilities, but was a call from one of the voices of the dead. In my dream, the hegemony consul was playing the Steinway on the balcony of his ebony spaceship, that spaceship that I knew so well, while great green saurian things surged and bellowed in the nearby swamps. He was playing Schubert. I did not recognize the world beyond the balcony, but it was a place of huge primitive plants, towering storm clouds, and frightening animal roars. The consul was a smaller man than I had always imagined. When he was finished with the piece, he sat quietly for a moment in the twilight, until the ship spoke in a voice I did not recognize, a smarter, more human voice. "Very nice," said the ship. "Very nice indeed." "Thank you, John," said the consul, rising from the bench and bringing the balcony into the ship with him. It was beginning to rain. "Do you still insist on going hunting in the morning?" asked the disembodied voice that was not the ship's as I knew it. "Yes," said the consul. "It is something I do here upon occasion." "Do you like the taste of dinosaur meat?" asked the ship's AI. "Not at all," said the consul. "Almost inedible. It is the hunt I enjoy." "You mean the risk," said the ship. "That too," the consul chuckled, "although I do take care." "But what if you don't come back from your hunt tomorrow?" asked the ship. His voice was of a young man with an old earth British accent. The consul shrugged. "We've spent, what, more than 6 years exploring the old hegemony worlds? We know the pattern. Chaos, civil war, starvation, fragmentation. We've seen the fruit of the fall of the Farcaster system." "Do you think that Gladstone was wrong in ordering the attack?" asked the ship softly. The consul had poured himself a brandy at the sideboard, and now carried it to the chess table set near the bookcase. He took a seat and looked at the game pieces already engaged in battle on the board in front of him. "Not at all," he said. "She did the right thing. But the result is sad. It will be decades, perhaps centuries, before the web begins to weave itself together in a new form." He had been warming the brandy and sloshing it gently as he spoke. Now he inhaled it and sipped. Looking up, the consul said, "Would you like to join me for the completion of our game, John?" The hollow of a young man appeared in the seat opposite. He was a striking young man with clear, hazel-colored eyes, low brow, hollow cheeks, a compact nose and stubborn jaw, and a wide mouth that suggested both a calm masculinity and a hint of pugnaciousness. The young man was dressed in a loose blouse and high-cut breeches. His hair was auburn-colored, thick and very curly. The consul knew that his guest had once been described as having a brisk, winning face, and he put that down to the easy mobility of expression that came with the young man's great intelligence and vitality. "Your move," said John. The consul studied his options for several moments and then moved a bishop. John responded at once, pointing to a pawn that the consul obediently moved one rank forward for him. The young man looked up with sincere curiosity in his eyes. "What if you don't come back from the hunt tomorrow?" he said softly. Startled out of his reverie, the consul smiled. "Then the ship is yours, which it obviously is anyway." He moved his bishop back. "What will you do, John, if this should be the end of our travels together?" John gestured to have his rook moved forward at the same lightning speed with which he replied. "Take it back to Hyperion," he said. "Program it to return to Braun if all is well. Or possibly to Martin Silenus, if the old man is still alive and working on his contos." "Program it?" said the consul, frowning at the board. "You mean you'd leave the ship's AI?" He moved his bishop diagonally another square. "Yes," said John, pointing to have his pawn advanced again. "I will do that in the next few days at any rate." His frown deepening, the consul looked at the board, then at the hologram across from him, and then at the board again. "Where will you go?" he said, and moved his queen to protect his king. "Back into the core," said John, moving the rook two spaces. "To confront your maker again?" asked the consul, attacking again with his bishop. John shook his head. His bearing was very upright, and he had the habit of clearing his forehead of curls with an elegant backward toss of his head. "No," he said softly. "To start raising hell with the core entities. To accelerate their endless civil wars and internecine rivalries. To be what my template had been to the poetic community, an irritant." He pointed to where he wanted his remaining knight moved. The consul considered that move, found it not a threat, and frowned at his own bishop. "For what reason?" he said at last. John smiled again and pointed to the square where his rook should next appear. "My daughter will need the help in a few years," he said. He chuckled. "Well, in 270-some years, actually." "Checkmate." "What?" said the consul, startled, and studied the board. "It can't be." John waited. "Damn," said the hegemony consul at last, tipping over his king. "Goddamn and spit in hell." "Yes," said John, extending his hand. "Thank you again for a pleasant game, and I do hope that tomorrow's hunt turns out more agreeably for you." "Damn," said the consul, and without thinking, attempted to shake the hologram's thin-fingered hand. For the 100th time, his solid fingers went through the other's insubstantial palm. "Damn," he said again. That night, in the Schrödinger cell, I awoke with two words echoing in my mind. The child. The knowledge that Ania had been married before our relationship had become a full-fledged love affair. The knowledge that she had given birth to a child had burned in my soul and gut like a painful ember. But except for my almost obsessive curiosity about who and why, curiosity unsatisfied by my questioning of Abetic, Rachel, and the others who had seen her leave during her odyssey with them, but who had no idea themselves where she had gone or with whom, I had not considered the reality of that child alive somewhere in the same universe I inhabited. Her child. The thought made me want to weep for several reasons. "The child is nowhere I can find it now," Ania had said. Where might that child be now? How old? I sat on my bunk in the Schrödinger cat box and pondered this. Ania had just turned 23 standard years old when she died. Correction, when she had been brutally murdered by the Corps and its PAX puppets. She had disappeared from sight for the 1 year, 11 months, 1 week, and 6 hours when she had just turned 20 years old. That would make the infant about 3 standard years old, plus the time I had spent here in the Schrödinger execution egg, 8 months, 10. I simply did not know, but if the child were still alive, he or she... My God, I had never asked Ania whether her baby had been a boy or girl, and she had not mentioned it the one time she had discussed the matter with me. I had been so involved with my own hurt and childish sense of injustice that I had not thought to ask her. What an idiot I had been. The child, Ania's son or Ania's daughter, would now be about 4 standard years old. Walking, certainly. Talking, yes. My God, I realized. Her child would be a rational human being at this point, talking, asking questions. A lot of questions, if my few experiences with young children were any indication. Learning to hike and fish and to love nature. I had never asked Ania her child's name. My eyes burned and my throat closed with the painful recognition of this fact. Again, she had shown no inclination to talk about that period in her life, and I had not asked. Telling myself in the weeks we had had together afterward that I did not want to upset her with questions or probings that would make her feel guilty and make me feel murderous. But Ania had shown no guilt when she had briefly told me about her marriage and child. To be honest, that is part of the reason I'd felt so furious and helpless at the knowledge. But somehow, incredibly, it had not stopped us from being lovers. How had it been phrased on the note I had found on my stylus screen months ago? The note I was sure was from Aeneas. Lovers of whom the poets would sing. That was it. The knowledge of her brief marriage and the child had not stopped us from feeling toward one another like lovers who had never experienced such emotion with another person. And perhaps she had not, I realized. I had always assumed that her marriage was one of sudden passion, almost impulse. But now I looked at it in another way. Who was the father? Aeneas' note had said that she loved me backward and forward in time, which is precisely the way I had discovered I felt about her. It was as if I had always loved her, had waited my entire life to discover the reality of that love. What if Aeneas' marriage had not been one of love or passion or impulse, but convenience? No, not the right word. Necessity? It had been prophesied by the Templars, the Austers, the Shrike cult church of the Final Atonement, and others, that Aeneas' mother, Braun Lamia, would bear a child, the one who teaches, Aeneas, as it turned out. According to the old poet's Kantos, on the day that the second John Keats Seibert had died a physical death, and Braun Lamia had fought her way to the Shrike temple for refuge, the Shrike cultists had chanted, "Blessed be the mother of our salvation, blessed be the instrument of our atonement," the salvation being Aeneas herself. What if Aeneas had been destined to have a child to continue this line of prophets, of messiahs? I had not heard any of these prophecies of another in Aeneas' line. But there was one thing I had discovered beyond argument during my month's writing of Aeneas' life. Rol Endymion was slow and thick-witted, usually the last to understand anything. Perhaps there had been as many prophecies of another one who teaches as there had been preceding Aeneas herself. Or perhaps this child would have completely different powers and insights that the universe and humanity had been awaiting. Obviously, I would not be the father of such a second messiah. The union of the second John Keats Seibert and Braun Lamia had been, by Aeneas' own accounts, the great reconciliation between the best elements of the Technocore and humanity itself. It had taken the abilities and perceptions of both AIs and human beings to create the hybrid ability to see directly into the void which binds, for humanity finally to learn the language of the dead and of the living. Empathy was another name for that ability. And Aeneas had been the child of empathy, if any title suited her. Who could the father of her child be? The answer struck me like a thunderbolt. For a second, there in the Schrödinger cat box, I was so shaken by the logic of it that I was sure that the particle detector clicking away periodically in the frozen energy wall of my prison had detected the emitted particle at exactly the right time and the cyanide had been released. What irony to figure things out and to die in the same moment. But it was not poison in the air. Only the growing strength of my certainty on this matter and the even stronger impulse to some action. There was one other player in the cosmic chess game Aeneas and the others had been playing for 300 standard years now, that near-mythical observer from the alien sentient races whom Aeneas had mentioned briefly in several different contexts. The lions and tigers and bears, the beings so powerful that they could kidnap old Earth to the lesser Magellanic Cloud rather than watch it be destroyed, had, according to Aeneas, sent among us one or more observers over the past few centuries. Entities who had, according to my interpretation of what Aeneas had said, taken on human form and walked among us for all this time. This would have been relatively easy during the Pax era with the virtual immortality of the cruciform so widespread. And there were certainly others who, like the ancient poet Martin Silenus, had stayed alive through a combination of world-web-era medicine, Poulsen treatments, and sheer determination. Martin Silenus was old, that was certain, perhaps the oldest human being in the galaxy. But he had not been the observer, that was equally certain. The author of the Cantos was too opinionated, too active, too visible to the public at large, too obscene, and generally just too damned cantankerous to be a cool observer, representing alien races so powerful that they could destroy us in an eye blink. Or so I hoped. But somewhere, probably somewhere I had never visited and could not imagine, that observer had been waiting and watching in human form. It made sense that Anea might have been compelled, by both prophecy and the necessity of unhindered human evolution she had taught about and believed in, to cast away from her odyssey to that distant world where the observer waited, meet him, mate with him, and bring that child into the universe. Thus would be reconciled the core, humanity, and the distant others. The idea was unsettling, definitely disturbing to me, but also exciting in a way that nothing had been since Anea's death. I knew Anea. Her child would be a human child, filled with life and laughter and a love of everything from nature to old holodramas. I had never understood how Anea could have left her child behind, but now I realized that she would have had no choice. She knew the terrible fate that awaited her in the basement cell of Castel Sant'Angelo. She knew that she would die by fire and torture while surrounded by inhuman enemies and the Nemes monsters. She had known this since before she was born. The fact of this made my knees weak. How could my dear friend have laughed with me so often, gone optimistically into new days so happily, celebrated life so thoroughly, when she knew that every day passing was another day closer to such a terrible death? I shook my head at the strength of will this implied. I did not have it, this I knew. Anea had. But she could not have kept the child with her, knowing when and how this terrible ending would take place. Presumably, then, the father was raising the child, the other in human form, the observer. I found this even more upsetting than my earlier revelations. I was struck then with the additional certainty that Anea would have wanted me to have some role in her child's life if she had thought it possible. Her own glimpses into possible futures presumably ended with her own death. Perhaps she did not know that I would not be executed at the same time. But then, she had asked me to scatter her ashes on old Earth, which assumed my survival. Perhaps she had thought it too much of a request to make, for me to find her child and to help in any way I could as the boy or girl came of age, to help protect it in a universe of sharp edges. I realized that I was weeping, not softly but with great ragged sobs. It was the first time I had wept like this since Anea's death, and, oddly enough, it was not primarily out of grief for Anea's absence, but at the thought of the second chance to hold a child's hand as I had once held Anea's when she was still 12 standard, of protecting this child of my beloved's as I had tried to protect my beloved, and failed. The indictment was my own. Yes, I had failed to protect Anea in the end, but she knew that I would fail, that she would fail in her quest to bring down the packs. She had loved me and loved life while knowing that we would fail. There was no reason I had to fail with this other child. Perhaps the observer would welcome my help, my sharing of the human experience, with this almost certainly more than human little boy or girl. I felt it safe to say that no one had known Anea better than I had. This would be important for the child's, for the new Messiah's upbringing. I would bring this narrative, now sitting useless in my scriber, and share bits and pieces of it with the boy or girl as he or she grew older, giving it all to him or her someday. I picked up the slate and scriber and paced back and forth in my Schrödinger cell. There was this small matter of my unavoidable execution. No one was coming to rescue me. The explosive shell of the egg had decided that, and if there were a way around that problem, someone would have been here by now. It was the most staggering improbability and good luck that I had survived this long, when every few hours there was another crapshoot with death, as the detector sniffed for the particle emission. I had beaten the laws of quantum chance for this long, but the luck could not hold. I stopped in my pacing. There had been four steps in Aeneas' teaching of our race's new relationship with the void which binds. Even before coming to my cell, I had experienced, if not mastered, learning the language of the dead and of the living. I had shown in my writing of the narrative that I could gain access to the void for at least old memories of those still living, even if the shell somehow interfered with my ability to sense what was happening now, with friends such as Father DeSoya, or Rachel, or Lomo, or Martin Silenus. Or was there interference? Perhaps I had subconsciously refused to try to contact the world of the living, at least for anything beyond memories of Aeneas. Since I knew that I now inhabited the world of the dead. No longer. I wanted out of here. There were two other steps that Aeneas had mentioned in her teaching but never fully explained. Hearing the music of the spheres and taking the first step. I now understood both these concepts. Without seeing Aeneas cast, and without that great rush of Gestalt understanding that had come with the terrible sharing of her death, I would not have understood. But I did now. I had thought of hearing the music of the spheres as a sort of paranormal radio telescope trick. Actually hearing the pop and crack and whistle of the stars as radio telescopes had for 11 centuries or more. But that had not been what Aeneas had meant at all, I realized. It was not the stars she was listening to and for, but the resonance of those people, human and otherwise, who dwelt among and around those stars. She had been using the void as a sort of directional beacon before farcasting herself. Much of her personal casting had not made sense to me. The core-controlled farcaster doors had been rough holes torn through the void, and thus through space-time, held open by the portals that were like crude clamps holding open the raw edges of a wound in the old days of scalpel surgery. Aeneas' farcasting, I now understood, was an infinitely more graceful device. I had wondered, in the busy time when Aeneas and I were free-casting down to planet surfaces, and from star system to star system in the Yggdrasil, how she had avoided having us blink into existence inside a hill or 50 meters above the surface, or the tree ship inside a star. It seemed to me that blind free-casting, like unplanned Hawking drive jumps, would be haphazard and disastrous. But we had always emerged exactly where we had to be when Aeneas cast us. Now I saw why. Aeneas heard the music of the spheres. She resonated with the void which binds, which resonates in turn to sentient life and thought. And then she used the almost illimitable energy of the void to take the first step, to travel via the void to where those voices waited. Aeneas had once said that the void tapped into the energy of quasars, of the exploding centers of galaxies, of black holes and black matter. Enough, perhaps, to move a few organic life forms through space-time and deposit them in the proper place. Love was the prime mover in the universe, Aeneas had once said to me. She had joked about being the Newton who someday explained the basic physics of that largely untapped energy source. She had not lived to do so. But I saw now what she had meant and how it worked. Much of the music of the spheres was created by the elegant harmonies and chord changes of love, free casting to where one's loved one waits. Learning a place after having traveled there with the one or ones you love. Loving to see new places. Suddenly, I understood why our first months together had been what had seemed at the time like useless farcaster wanderings from world to world. Mare Infinitus, Comriad, Hebron, Saldraconi Septum, the unnamed world where we had left the ship, all of the others, even old Earth. There had been no working farcaster portals. Aeneas had swept Abetic and me with her to these places, touching them, sniffing their air, feeling their sunlight on her skin, seeing them all with friends, with someone she loved, learning the music of the spheres so that it could be played later. And my own solo odyssey, I thought. the kayak forecasting from old Earth to Lucis, and the cloud planet, and all the other places. Anea had been the energy behind that casting, sending me to places so that I could taste them and find them again someday on my own. I had thought, even as I wrote the narrative in the scriber that I held under my arm there in the Schrodinger death cell, that I had been little more than a fellow traveler in a series of picaresque adventures. But it had all held a purpose. I had been a lover traveling with my love, or to my love, through a musical score of worlds, a score that I had to learn by heart, so that I could play it again someday. I closed my eyes in the Schrodinger cat box and concentrated, then went beyond concentration to the empty mind state I had learned in meditation on Tian Shan. Every world had its purpose. Every minute had its purpose. In that unhurried emptiness, I opened myself to the void which binds and the universe to which it resonated. I could not do this, I realized, without communion with Anea's blood, without the nanotech-tailored organisms that now dwelt in my cells and would dwell in my children's cells. No, I thought at once, not my children, but in the cells of those in the human race who escaped the cruciform, in their children's cells. I could not do this without having learned from Anea. I could not have heard the voices I heard then, greater choruses than I had ever heard before, without having honed my own grammar and syntax of the language of the dead and living during the months I worked on the narrative while waiting to die. I could not do this, I realized, if I were immortal. This degree of love of life and of one another is granted, I saw for once and forever, not to immortals, but to those who live briefly and always under the shadow of death and loss. As I stood there, listening to the swelling chords of the music of the spheres, able now to pick out separate star voices in the chorus, Martin Silenus's, still alive but failing on my home world of Hyperion, Theo's on beautiful Maui Covenant, Rachel's on Barnard's world, Colonel Cassad's on Red Mars, Father DeSoya's on Pacham, and even the lovely chords of the dead. Demria's on Vitus Grey Balianus B. Dear Father Glaucus's on cold Sol Draconi Septum. My mother's voice, again on distant Hyperion. I also heard John Keats's words, in his voice, and in Martin Silenus's, and in Aeneas. But this is human life. The war, the deeds, the disappointment, the anxiety. Imagination struggles, far and nigh, all human, bearing in themselves this good, that they are still the air, the subtle food, to make us feel existence, and to show how quiet death is. Where soil is, men grow, whether to weeds or flowers. But for me, there is no depth to strike in. But the opposite was true of me at that moment. There was more than enough depth to strike in. The universe deepened at that moment. The music of the spheres grew from a mere chorus to a symphony as triumphant as Beethoven's Ninth, and I knew that I would always be able to hear it when I wished or needed to, always be able to use it to take the step I needed to see the one I loved, or, failing that, step to the place where I had been with the one I loved, or, failing that, find a place to love for its own beauty and richness. The energy of quasars and exploding stellar nuclei filled me then. I was borne up on waves of energy more lovely and more lyrical even than the ouster angel's wings seen sliding along corridors of sunlight. The shell of deadly energy that was my prison and execution cell seemed laughable now. Schrodinger's original joke, a child's jump rope laid around me on the ground as restraining walls. I stepped out of the Schrodinger cat box and out of Armagast system. For a moment, feeling the confines of the Schrodinger prison fall away and behind me forever, existing nowhere and everywhere in space, but remaining physically intact in my body and stylus and scriber, I felt a surge of sheer exhilaration, as powerful as the dizzying effect of solo farcasting itself. Free! I was free! The wave of joy was so intense that it made me want to weep, to shout into the surrounding light of no space, to join my voice with the chorus of voices of the living and dead, to sing along with the crystal-clear symphonies of the spheres, rising and plunging like a solid, acoustic surf all around me. Free at last! And then I remembered that the one reason to be free, the one person who would make such freedom worthwhile, was gone. Aeneas was dead. The sheer joy of escape faded suddenly and absolutely, replaced by a simple but profound satisfaction at my release from so many months of imprisonment. The universe might have had the color drained out of it for me, but at least now I was free to go anywhere I wanted within that monotone realm. But where was I going? Floating on light, free-casting into the universe with my stylus and scriber tucked under my arm, I still had not decided. Hyperion? I had promised to return to Martin Silenus. I could hear his voice resonating strong in the void, past and present, but it would not be part of the current chorus for long. His life remaining could now be counted in days or less. But not to Hyperion, not yet. The Biosphere Star Tree? I was shocked to hear that it still existed in some form, although Lomo's voice was absent from the choral symphony there. The place had been important to Aeneas and me, and I had to return someday. But not now. Old Earth? Amazingly, I heard the music of that sphere quite clearly, in Aeneas' former voice and in mine, in the song of the friends at Taliesin with whom we had tallied there. Distance meant nothing in the void which binds. Time there seasons but does not destroy. But not to old Earth, not now. I heard scores of possibilities, more scores of voices I wanted to hear in person, people to hug and weep with. But the music I reacted to, most strongly now, was from the world where Aeneas had been tortured and killed. Pacem. Home of the church and nest of our enemies. Not, I saw now, the same thing. Pacem. There was, I knew, nothing of Aeneas for me on Pacem but ashes of the past. But she had asked me to take her ashes and spread them on old earth. Spread them where we had laughed and loved most well. Pacem. In the vortex of void energy, already stepping beyond the Schrödinger cell, but existing nowhere else except as pure quantum probability, I made my decision and free cast for Pacem.